Trumos, Perek Beis, Mishnah Aleph. Another Mishnah here talking about having two separate, let's say, containers, A and B, and in these two containers you have produce of different statuses. But unlike the previous Mishnayos, the produce in these two statuses have identical obligations with respect to Truma. That is to say, they're on the same footing. The difference is just that one is Tameh and one is Tahor. So under normal circumstances, really midoraisa, there's no reason why you couldn't take Truma on one on behalf of the other. However, first it should be noted that if you take from the Tameh on behalf of the Tahor, you're really shortchanging the Kohen, because the Kohen can do nothing with the Tameh Truma except burn it and get benefit from it as it burns, which isn't very useful if you're talking about grapes or something. It is, of course, if you have olive oil, you can burn it for fuel and light, but a grape would not be very useful if it was Tameh. So in the next mission, we'll come to that topic of taking Tameh on behalf of Tahor. But in this mission, we're talking about taking Tahor on behalf of Tameh. That is to say, in container B, you have Tahor, let's say even grapes, and you're taking them, Truma, from B on behalf of B as well as A. And in A, container A, you have Tameh grapes. Now, it sounds like that should be a good deal for the Kohen, because the Kohen, if you gave him exactly, you know, prorated amounts, like just for example, if you had 50 grapes in A and 50 grapes in B, and the 50 grapes in A are Tameh, the 50 grapes in B are Tahor, so you owe him two grapes. If you gave him one grape from the Tameh and one grape from the Tahor, so that's his fair share, but he only has one grape to eat. Whereas if you gave him two grapes from the Tahor, you're giving him actually two edible grapes. That seems like a good deal to him. Nevertheless, the Mishnah is going to say one may not do that. And the reason why is something totally extraneous to the halachas we discussed so far. There's a separate halacha altogether, which is that when one takes truma, or challah for that matter, it has to be, if there's multiple containers or piles or sets of food that's being tied collectively, that they have to be close together. What's called minha mukaf. Mukaf means like surrounding, nearby. The exact technical details about what constitutes sufficiently close together and combined is pretty involved. We'll discuss it in Maseches Challah, Be'ez Hashem. But for now, suffice it to say that under these circumstances, one would have to put the grapes close together. And the concern is that if you put them too close together, then the grapes might touch one another in a way that conveys tuma from the tummy to the tahor, and you're not allowed to do that. And you're not allowed to be matama grapes. If they're truma grapes, you can't convey tuma to them. And therefore, the rabbis were concerned that you would go out of your way to keep them too far apart and not fulfill the requirements of min hamukaf, of having them in close proximity, sufficiently. So it's perhaps even a derabbanan to protect the derabbanan, although plenty of Rishonim learn that the requirement for a mukaf is a deraisa. Whatever the case, since we were afraid that you wouldn't keep them sufficiently close out of fear that they are going to spread tuma one to the other, therefore the rabbi said you shouldn't take even tahor on behalf of tameh. So that's what the Mishnah says. It starts out by saying, Ein tormin mitahor al hatameh. You shouldn't take tahor grapes, let's say, for argument's sake, or anything else for that matter, al hatameh, on behalf of tameh grapes. Vim tarmu, truma san truma. If you do, however, after the fact, it works, because midoraisa said it's totally effective. Now, be'emes amru, the truth is they said, and whenever the Mishnah says be'emes amru, it means that we're going to say, what we're saying now is really incontrovertible, it's not to be disputed, no proof is available or required, it's black and white, like halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. And many times it actually means it is a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, which means a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai means that it's a tradition we have, it's a doraisa that goes back to Har Sinai from Moshe himself, but it doesn't have any embedded reference or drasha in psukim to pull it out. It's just a tradition we have, that's the case. Like, for example, that tefillin should be black is a halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai. There's no pasuk that requires black tefillin or even a drasha to extract from the psukim that there should be black, that tefillin should be black. But nevertheless, we have a tradition that goes all the way back that they must be black. That's called the halach l'moshe mi-Sinai. So here we're saying what we're about to say is as true and incontrovertible as a halach l'moshe mi-Sinai, although it may not necessarily be literally a halach l'moshe mi-Sinai, and certainly if we're talking about the Rabbanans, it wouldn't be the case. Sometimes the Mishnayos, as the Bartanur points out here, it'll use this expression referring to black and white Rabbanans, like in Masechah Shabbos, whatever the case is. So anyways, Be'emes Amru means this is the undeniable, indisputable fact that If you have an eagle shell devela, shenitza miktsaso, if you have a cake of pressed figs and part of the cake became tame, that is to say that if you have a bunch of pressed figs together, they're not considered to be a single unit, such that if, let's say, a dead rat touched one of the figs, all the figs become equally tame as a rishon. We do not say that. The figs are not, there's not a chibur, a legal connection between the figs that would allow for the equal treatment in terms of, you know, equal reception of tumah across all the units that comprise that pressed cake. No, each fig still stands on its own, which would mean that the figs that get directly exposed and touch the rat would become a rishon, and whatever figs are touching those figs would become a sheni, and whatever figs are touching those figs remain tahor, because chulin, this is tevel, but it's, you know, it's chulin, meaning it's not yet truma, can't become tameh as a shlishi. So that means that you'd have like halfway through, if you will. If you imagine, let's say, for argument's sake, it's five figs pressed in a line. So the first fig on the outer that touches, let's say there's a dead rat on the left. So the dead rat touches the leftmost fig, it becomes a rishon. The fig next to it, the second from the left, becomes a sheni. And the remaining three figs on the right stay tahor. So we're going to say that in such a scenario, you have something that's essentially, if you think about it, the equivalent of our previous case of having two containers A and B, where, you know, A has the tum and B has the tahor. Here you have two sides, let's call it right and left, where the right has the tahor and the left has the tummy. But here we're going to say that although in the previous line of the mission we said you shouldn't take from tahor on behalf of tummy, here we're saying you may take from the tahor figs in the pressed fig cake on behalf of the tummy figs. The reason why, even though it's structurally identical, is because there's no reason to make this din d'rabbanan about, you know, min hamukaf, keeping the figs too far apart, because as it is, they're already stuck together. So you know, it's too late. The horse has left the barn already in terms of that. So since there's nothing to happen in terms of keeping them apart or putting them together, so now the din d'rabbanan doesn't apply, and you could take from the tahor on behalf of tummy. So back inside, Be'emes Amru, the truth is that the rabbi said, in an incontrovertible way, as if it were halacha l'moshe Sinai, ha'igel shel devela, shenitma miktsaso, if you have a cake of pressed figs, and part of it became tameh, tore min ha'tar sheyeshbo, ala tameh sheyeshbo, you may take, in such a case, from the tahor part of the figs on behalf of the tameh figs as well. V'chein, and the same would apply if you have an aguda shel yarak, you have a bundle of vegetables, think, you know, carrots tied together, v'chein arema, and the same goes if you have a big mound of grain, a big pile, and let's say part of the carrots or part of the grain in the mound became tame, another part is tahor. In those cases, you may take from the tahor on behalf of the tame, because now already they're touching and mixed together as it is. The next line of the Mishnah may have not much of a great chiddush at all, and it's going to just simply say a sort of middle case where you have hayu shnei agulin, shnei agudos, or shnei aremos, if you have two cakes or two bundles of fig cakes or two bundles of vegetables or two mounds, piles of grain, achas tameva achas tahora, one of which is tamin, one of which is tahor. Lo yisro mezelze, so you shouldn't take from the tahor on behalf of the tamay, very much like we said in the beginning of the Mishnah. We're just now bringing a middle case where instead of having containers, whatever the story is, we have our very same fig cakes, bundles of vegetables, or mounds of grain. And fine. That's the halacha follows what we said up to now. However, Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Rabbi Eliezer is going to argue, and he says, Tarmin min atar latame. He says, you may, in contrast to what we said before, you may take from tahor B on behalf of tame A, no problem. In other words, he's just not concerned at all about this min hamukaf issue, that you'll be afraid to put them together sufficiently because of tumah spreading. Since he has no concern about that, he has no problem with you taking the tahor on the path of the tummy. However, the halacha does not follow him. Trumos, Perek Beis, Mishnah Beis, 2-2. This is the last of the Mishnayos with this kind of setup of having two containers, A and B, where you're taking, let's say, for example, you have 15 A and 15 B, and you want to take the 2%, meaning 2, all from B on behalf of both A and B, if you can do it. And the particular case we have here is, like the previous Mishnah, one container has tummy and one container has tahor produce. But in the previous Mishnah, we said you were taking from tahor on behalf of tameh. And we're saying, even though you're doing the Kohen a favor, so to speak, by giving him 2 units of Tahor, we had for extraneous reasons, because this fear of Min HaMukkah, putting them close together, or not putting them close together enough, because you're afraid they'll get Tameh, that the rabbi said not to do it. But here in Mishnah Beis, we're going the other way around. You're proposing to take Tameh produce on behalf of Tahor. So again, Midoraisa, that's going to work, but what you're doing really is totally messing up the Kohen. You're kind of cheating him, because think it through. If you had 50 Tameh and 50 Tahor, and you gave the Kohen his fair share on a prorated basis, you give him one of each. And the Kohen would eat the Tahor one. And the Tameh thing, he can't eat, he can burn. And if it, you know, provides him use in terms of as a fuel source, he can get benefit. But obviously, he'd much rather have food to eat than, you know, figs to burn or something. So you're cheating him, you're messing him up. And here the rabbi said, no, we don't want you to do that. Although it works midoraisa, since you're sort of ending up really giving the Kohen the short end of the stick, we're not letting you do it. But with qualifications. So the Mishnah here is going to say inside, Ein tarmin min hatame al hatahor. You may not take tame produce as truma on behalf of tahor. Again, so you have A and B. B has the tame, A has the tahor, and you take 2 out of the tame B on behalf of A and B together. You can't do that, says the Mishnah. V'im tarim, and if you did, well, midoraisa works, but we're going to now say potentially midorabana, we're not letting it happen. So, shogeg, if it was a shogeg, that is to say, it was inadvertent. You didn't know that the tame produce was tame. For argument's sake, you thought A and B were equally tahor, and after you took 2 from B on behalf of B and A together, someone tells you, oh gosh, what was in B was actually tame. So that was a shogeg you didn't know. And that being the case, truma so truma. After the fact, bidyeved, you shouldn't have done it, but now you didn't know better and you did an accident. Well, now it worked midoraisa, so you have 2 units from B and they're tame and the Kohen has to make do. Umezid, on the other hand, if you did it willfully, meaning you knew full well that what was in A was tame, what was in A was tahor and what was in B was tame, and yet you took from B both on behalf of A and B, so you're really cheating the Kohen on purpose. So then, lo asa klum, the rabbis put their foot down, and they like pull the rug out from under you. Even though the Torah says it works, the rabbi says, no, it does not work. Which is pretty remarkable. You see here that the rabbis have the power to actually inhibit what would otherwise work in the Torah from working. And they don't empower you to do that taking of truma, because we don't want to make the Kohen lose, and therefore we just disallow it altogether. So, and that's that. Now, the next line of the Mishnah says a similar principle applies. V'chein, b'nei Levi, if you have a Levi, Shehaya lo, and what does he have? He has his Maaser Rishon. But this Maaser Rishon is Maaser Tevel, meaning it's mice that hasn't been tithed yet. So let's keep it really simple, even simpler than the Bar Tzanura does here, and just simply say this is Maaser that he has. He'll have to give 10% of it as Trumas Maaser. That's what he's got it put in his cupboard, and it's tummy. So what's he doing? He's basically going around town collecting Maaser from his neighbors. And every time he gets Maaser, let's say these were what he got first and put in his cupboard, let's say is 10 liters of wine, 10 liters of Maaser wine. So he has it's Tevel, meaning he hasn't taken the Trumas Maaser from it. So what he has to do is take at least 1 of the 10 and give that to a Kohen. But what he does instead is he keeps the 10 in his cupboard, and then he goes to his neighbors, and every time he collects 10 more liters of wine from his neighbors, he says, listen, I owe 1/10 of this as Trumas Maaser, but I'm not going to give from the 10 I've just collected from my neighbors. I'll just ascribe, I'll put the Trumas Maaser, 1 more liter, and assign it to the 10 liters I have in my cupboard back at home. So that works. The halachas of Min HaMukkaf actually, midoraisa require just the Truma Gadola and Chala. They don't apply to Trumas Maaser at all. But anyways, even putting Min HaMukkaf aside, the point is, one could do this, and the Kohen, let's say our Levi is doing that. So, but our case is, now the Levi has the 10 liters of wine in his cupboard back home, but they're tummy. So what's happening is, exactly like in the previous part of the Mishnah, he's taking tummy Trumas Maaser on behalf of Tahor Maaser. So again, he's essentially, net-net, he's cheating the Kohen, because when he delivers these 10 liters, ultimately, whatever it is, of Trumas Maaser to the Kohen, Kohen can do nothing with it. He can't drink it. It's all tummy. So if he's doing that, well, will it work? Same as we said before, if he knew what he was doing, it won't. But if he didn't know what he was doing, it was inadvertent, it was a shogeg, it will. So the Mishnah says inside, Hayamafresh alav v'holech, he keeps on designating Trumas Meiser from his newly collected Meiser on what he had back home, from the original Meiser Tevel. If he, and that Meiser Tevel back home in his cupboard is Tameh. So if he did it shogeg, he didn't realize it was Tameh, he didn't know, then Masha Asa Asui, what he did is done. Meaning, indeed, the new Trumas Meiser back in his cupboard is Cohen property and everything worked. But Mazid, if he purposefully was just allocating Tameh wine to the Cohen, so even though Midoraisa works, the rabbi says, no way, Lo Asa Klum, we say that was totally invalid and the taking of the Truma, designation of Trumas Meiser, didn't do anything. And he has to tie this again. Good. Just an important point the Bartanura speaks out is that, let's say in the first case, when we're talking about the taking the Truma, where we say what's done is done after the fact, if it's a shogeg, the Bartanura speaks out that only applies where the produce in question has finished being, you know, gemar malacha, has finished being processed, and therefore the time, the time which requires you to take Truma has kicked in. That's when we'll say what's done is done. But if, says the Bar Tanura, the produce we're talking about that was Tameh hadn't even reached Gemar Malacha yet, so then, and there's no definitive obligation yet to take Truma, then we'll say, no, the Truma wasn't effective and you have to go do it again, even in the Shogeg case. Hard to see exactly how it would apply in the case here about the Meiser, because Meiser already been collected, it's finished its production. Okay. On all that, Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, he says, listen, it's not so simple. He has a middle case. What happens if, says Rabbi Yehuda, you didn't know that it was Tameh, and therefore what we said before is Shogeg, but what happens if someone had told you, you just forgot? So someone said, what you have in container B is Tameh, then you forgot that he told you that, then you assigned the Truma to the stuff in container B, and that's it. And then someone reminds you, oh no, that was Tameh. So does that count as being a shogeg because of the time that you did it, you didn't know? Or no, since you were told before, so you can't just now forget it and say it's shogeg. It's what's called a shogeg karov lemezid, perhaps, which means it's like, it's a shogeg because you didn't know, it was inadvertent, but it's pretty borderline to being negligent, and therefore you can't call it close to being willful what you did. So Rabbi Yehuda says, indeed, it is karov lemezid and it won't work. So that's what Rabbi Yehuda says, Rabbi Omer, Im haya yodea bo betchila, if you had known that what was in B was Tameh, you just forgot, you can't just call it a shogeg now. Afa pi shu shogeg, even if when you did it, you had forgotten and you inadvertently assigned the Tameh stuff in B to be the Truma, but no, it's not good enough, lo asa klum, the rabbis say in such a case, says Rabbi Yehuda, that the taking of Truma doesn't work. It's like doing it by Mazid. It's a shogeg karov of Mazid. It's a shogeg that's very close to Mazid. However, the halacha doesn't follow Rabbi Yehuda. The halacha follows Tanakama. So even if you knew but forgot, it could still be a shogeg. Meseches Trumos, Perek Beis, Mishnah Gimel 2-3. The previous Mishnah had said that if one would tithe Tameh food on behalf of Tar food, so then if he does it b'shogeg, inadvertently not knowing what he was doing at the time, then it's effective. But if it's bemazed, if he's intentionally, purposely ties taking tummy on behalf of untummy food, then the rabbi said, no, we penalize him and we won't let it happen. We force him to take it again to protect the Kohen. On that topic here in Mishnah Gimel, we depart for a moment from the topics of Trumos altogether, and we discuss other areas of halacha where we differentiate between shogeg and mazed, intentional and unintentional violations of various halachas, some derabanan and some doraisa. Now, to understand this Mishnah properly, we have to dig deep for a moment to understand what's going on behind the scenes. Our Mishnah is going according to the Tana Rebbe Meir, as the case with the vast majority of Mishnayos, where there's no attribution, there's Stam Mishnah, they're just anonymous, there's no particular Tana named as the author of the Mishnah. So then the assumption is that this is a Mishnah that was originally formulated by Rebbe Meir, or his tradition, which was Rebbe Yehuda Nasi. When he codified the Mishnayos, he took Rebbe Meir's version. So this will reflect the Shita of Rebbe Meir. And that being the case, we have to understand what Rebbe Meir holds. So Rebbe Meir holds that when it comes to Doraisa mitzvahs, there is no such thing as penalties for shogeg violations. That is to say, if a person did the wrong thing on accident. He didn't intend to do the wrong thing. So the chips will fall where they may. Maybe he has to bring a korban or whatever the things will be, they will be. But there's no additional rabbinic kanas, a penalty against a shogeg, an inadvertent violation of a doraisa. Whereas if a person willfully violates the Torah, he does it in Isser Doraisa Bemezid, violates the Torah purposefully, intentionally. So then there will be penalties so that the sinner doesn't benefit, doesn't prosper. So he, again, Reb Meir holds in Doraisas, there's no penalties for Shogegs, there is a penalty for Mezid. When it comes to Durabanans, so Reb Meir will hold that many times there's no penalty at all. But when there is a penalty, and the rabbis did say, you know, we're not going to let you get away with this, so we'll penalize you in some way. So then they did not differentiate between intentional and unintentional violations. It's all the same. But the Rebbe Meir is standing up for the and reinforcing the authority of the Rabbanim. And they say, where the Rabbanim say there's a penalty, then there's no difference between an intentional or an unintentional violation. The penalty, where applied, applies across the board. So Rebbe Meir is standing up, if you will, for the authority and reinforcing the authority of the Rabbanim. As we'll see in just a minute, though, there's some exceptions to that rule, and I'll say that right now. Look inside. It says, Hamatbil Kalim b'Shabbos. If a person immerses Kalim in a mikvah on Shabbos. Now, this is not talking about the Tevilas Kalim that you are probably familiar with. That is, when a person acquires a new utensil that came from a non-Jew, manufactured by a non-Jew, and that utensil is made out of one of the various materials, you know, that require immersion in mikvah before first-time use, metal, for example. So we're not talking about that. In fact, according to the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, that it might be permissible l'charchila to do that immersion on Shabbos. He brings a Yesh Ostrom. He says some people say no. It's in Or Chaim Shin Chaf Gimel Sif Zayin, if you want to look it up over there, and there's a Mishnah Berurah, a lot to say. But in any case, we're not talking about that, which might be permissible on Shabbos. What we're talking about here is a kli that is tame, and a person wants to immerse in the mikvah to be metahirit, to get rid of the tumah status. So that is an issa d'rabbanan. That is to say, if one does immerse a kli on Shabbos in a mikvah, the kli does become tahor. But the rabbi said not to do it because it resembles tikkun mana, it resembles mitaken of repairing a utensil, and repairing a utensil is a violation potentially of the Isra Doraisa of Makbapatish. So since this is certainly not Makbapatish, but it looks like it is on some level, the rabbi said don't even do it so people won't come to do Makbapatish. So in other words, when we're summing up here, we're saying there's a prohibition midrabanan not to immerse tame utensils in mikvah on Shabbos. So our Mishnah's case is, what if a person went ahead and did it anyways? Hamat bil kelim b'Shabbos. One did immerse his tame kli on Shabbos, despite the rabbi saying not to do it. So the Mishnah says, shogeg, if he didn't know it was tame at the time, or that it was Shabbos at the time, or that it was forbidden to do such a thing at the time, so then yishtamish behem, we will let him use this kli. Certainly if he has no other kli to use, we'll let him use this kli, because we don't have Shabbos, he messed up, he has no, you know, whatever dishes to eat on or something like that. But mezid, if he knew full well that the kli was tame and that he shouldn't be immersing it on Shabbos, but he did it anyways, so then lo yishtamash behem, we now penalize him and we say you may not use these kelim for Shabbos, to send him back, so now he can't, he won't benefit from having violated the rabbanan injunction not to do tefillas kelim on Shabbos. So that's straightforward. The only problem is, if this mishnah is like Rabbi Meir, and it is like Rabbi Meir, so then I just finish saying in the introduction how, if we're talking about a rabbinic enactment, and this is rabbinic, not to do tefillas kelim on Shabbos, of tamei kelim, we said that Rav Meir doesn't differentiate between shogeg and mezid, and nevertheless over here, we certainly see that he says if it's a shogeg that a person immersed the utensil, then he could use it, whereas mezid he couldn't, so we are differentiating, of course. So the answer is that over here, the rabbis are concerned that if he doesn't have utensils to use on Shabbos, his Shabbos is messed up. We don't want that to happen unnecessarily. And what was he doing after all? He was attempting to do the right thing. He was trying to eat b'tahara. He didn't.
he was shogeg. He didn't know what he was doing was wrong, and he thought he was doing a great a mitzvah of fixing up his utensils. And that being the case, this is an exception to the rule of Reb Meir. And since he was trying to do the right thing and he acted with shogeg, we won't penalize him over here in the event where he needs these utensils for Shabbos, because that'll mess up his Shabbos and that's going too far. So there's an exception to the rule because we want to protect his Shabbos and because he was trying to do the right thing and doing the tefillah. And his act was just shogeg. So it's an exception. The next line of the Mishnah says, Hama'aser v'hamavashel b'Shabbos, if a person tithes or a person cooks on Shabbos. So now, that's a mouthful, because tithing on Shabbos is an Isser D'Rabbanan. The rabbis, similar to the previous clause of the Mishnah, the rabbi said that people shouldn't tithe their food on Shabbos, because again, it appears like you're fixing the food, and that's like, again, one step away from Makba Patish. So therefore, the rabbi said not to tithe the food on Shabbos, you have to tithe it before Shabbos. On the other hand, cooking on Shabbos, Mavashel, that is an Isra Doraisa, of course, is one of the 39 Malachas. Bishel is a big no-no, carries with it the penalty of death, even if one does it b'mezid, with Edom and Hasra, and certainly if he does it b'shogeg, he has to bring a chatas and the sin offering. So, totally different things. And yet the Mishnah conflates them, it lumps them together, and it says, shogeg, if the person did this tithing or cooking inadvertently or not knowing that it was Shabbos or whatever that was forbidden, then yochel, we let him eat the food still. Mezid, on the other hand, if he knew full well what he was doing was wrong, then lo yochel, we say he can't eat it on Shabbos. So here again, let's take them one step at a time. The first one is the rabbinic prohibition against tithing food on Shabbos. So it's very similar to the previous clause. We're saying if it's inadvertent, we don't penalize you. If it's intentional, we do penalize you. And it's the same thinking as the previous clause in the Mishnah. Here, this person didn't know what he's doing was wrong. He's trying to do the right thing, doing a mitzvah of tithing food, and he needs the food for Shabbos. So if it's true, he needs the food for Shabbos, and it's true that he was trying to do the right thing, and it's true that he didn't know what he's doing was wrong, so then we won't penalize him, despite the usual rule, which is, by Rabbi Meir, that we penalize shogeg and mezid equally. Here, because it has those features of not, we don't ruin his Shabbos, he needs the food, presuming that's true, and he was trying to do the right thing. So this is an exception to the rule, and we will let him eat the food even on Shabbos after tithing it. However, that's what's an exception. Now, let's talk about the Doraisa. The Doraisa now of cooking on Shabbos, that follows good old Reb Meir's general principle, which is when it comes to Doraisas, Torah violations, we don't have penalties for shogeg. And that's why we said if he cooked it unwittingly, not knowing he was going to cook, or not knowing that it was Shabbos, not knowing that it was Asr on Shabbos, then yochel, we let him eat the food anyways, because Reb Meir's shita is, there's no penalty on Shabbos applied when one violates Shabbos b'shogeg. On the other hand, if it's a mezid, if he willfully violated Shabbos, so then we certainly do penalize him, and we say lo yochel, he may not eat this food on Shabbos now, he gets no benefit from his Shabbos violation. Now, important to note, there's a machlokas between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda on these halachas, and many paskin like Rabbi Yehuda, including our hero in this shiur, the Bar Tanura, the Rav, who paskins like the Rambam, and that's how the Mechaber and the Shulchan Aruch paskins, we paskin like Rabbi Yossi, which is not like Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yossi holds sort of the diametric opposite of Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yossi holds that we, when it comes to Doraisas, we do apply a kanas, a penalty. Reb Meir said, we don't penalize shogeg. Reb Meir says, yes, we do. And when it comes to Durabanans, we said that Rabbi Meir, sort of to reinforce the authority of the rabbis, he penalizes shogeg and amazes it equally, whereas Rabbi Yehuda says, nope, not necessarily. We will let shogeg slide, whereas amazes it we will penalize. So the halacha in this case, at least according to the Rambam and the Mechaber, although there are plenty who argue and like the Gra and others who paskin that the halacha does follow our Mishnah. But the Bar Tanura, who I'm going to follow, because I always follow him here in this year, says that the halacha goes like Rabbi Yossi, and therefore you have to understand that, and certainly it's the halacha for Sephardim, that's for sure, that we are going to lemaisa not follow this Mishnah, and we're going to say that if a person cooks on Shabbos, even b'shogeg, it's forbidden to him on Shabbos, till after Shabbos, and if he cooks b'mezid intentionally on Shabbos, then it's usher to him forever, even after Shabbos. He can never eat that food, and others will have to wait till after Shabbos to eat it as well. That's an amazing scenario. And that's the halacha l'maisa according to the Bartanura. Just an important side point here. You may be familiar, even according to Rav Meir, even we say if he did it b'mezid, he can't eat it on Shabbos. The question is, after Shabbos, how long does he have to wait? So you may well be familiar with the principle of bechdei she'yasu, which is you have to wait the amount of time it would take to do it. So kdei she'yasu would mean if it takes an hour to cook this food, so then if it was cooked on Shabbos, and there's a, we're saying you can't eat it till after Shabbos, so kdei she'yasu would mean you have to wait a full hour after Shabbos before you can eat the food. You can't eat it right away because then you're sort of benefiting, you're saving yourself an hour cooking time if you cook it on Shabbos. So although Rashi understands indeed that this is Bechdei She'yasu would apply over here, the overwhelming majority of Rishonim, the Rambam, many others, and the Halacha L'maisa, is that there's no such thing as Kdei She'yasu, the amount of time it takes to do it after Shabbos, in the realm of these things. It only applies in the realm of Amir L'Akum. It applies in the area where one has gotten a non-Jew to do Malacha for him on Shabbos. So when one acted inappropriately and had a non-Jew do something for him on Shabbos for his benefit where that was not permitted, so then we penalize him, we say you can't get benefit from that malacha done on Shabbos, you have to wait till after Shabbos. And there the halacha will be, you have to wait not just till after Shabbos, but wait the amount of time it takes to have done what the goy did anyways, and that way you benefit nothing for having get him to do it on Shabbos. So there the rabbis basically said, since people are liable to try to get non-Jews to do work for them on Shabbos, we have a penalty which says you not only can you not under most circumstances, but if he does, you have to wait the amount of time it takes to do it by yourself, that, you know, so you get no benefit in terms of time saving either. But in the context of this halacha and this mishnah, where we're talking about a Jew doing the cooking on Shabbos, there would be no Bechdei She'yasu issue according to Rambam and most others. It means the Reb Meir would hold, if it's shogeg, eat it on Shabbos. If it's amazing, wait till immediately after Shabbos. And Reb Yehuda would hold, if it's shogeg, you have to wait till after Shabbos. And if it's mazid, then you can, but immediately thereafter you could eat it, no bechdei she'yasu. And if you did it b'mazid, then it's usher to you forever, you can never eat that food, and other people have to wait till after Shabbos. Okay. Now, the Mishnah continues and it says now, hanotea b'shabbos, what about planting a tree? So if one plants a tree on Shabbos, that's also an iser d'oraisa. It's a tolda of Zoreya. One of the third nine categories of forbidden labor is Zoreya, sowing seeds, planting seeds in the ground, and Noteya, which the Pashas simply mean, probably means planting a tree, like a sapling in the ground, or replanting a sapling, as the case may be. So that's what it means. So then that's also an Issa Doraisa. It's not the Av of Zoreya, but it's the Tolda, a subcategory of Zoreya, of planting a tree, Natiya. And that is just like cooking, it's Usser Medoraisa. And therefore the halacha is, this is Rabbi Meir speaking, Rabbi Meir holds, since it's Doraisa, we don't penalize Shogig, and therefore Shogig, if a person planted this tree not knowing it was Shabbos, or not knowing that was Usser to do on Shabbos, then Yikayem, then he can be Mekayim, he can maintain that tree after Shabbos, no need to uproot it. But Mezid, if he intentionally planted that tree on Shabbos, so then Yaakor, he can't get away with that, will force him to now uproot that tree, so he gets no benefit from the Malacha done on Shabbos. And that's certainly true, even though the tree won't take root till way after Shabbos, but putting it in the ground in the first place is Aser. And that being the case, since he acted b'mezid intentionally, we don't let him get away with it. We penalize, says Rav Meir, we penalize mezid violations of Doraisas. Finally, Uva Shvias. What about in the Shemitah year? In the Shemitah year, it's also prohibited to plant. Zriya is certainly an Issa Doraisa. Natiya, if it's a replanting of a tree, it's actually a contentious point. Let's assume for simplicity, we're talking about planting trees here, and let's assume for simplicity's sake that planting trees on the seventh year of the Shemitah cycle in Shvias is an Issa Doraisa also. Keep it simple for now. And that being the case, Uba Shvias, Bein Shogeg B'Mezid Yaakor. If he violates the Torah and plants on Shemitah year, whether he did it Shogeg or Mezid, we force him to uproot it. Now, we're talking about a Doraisa here, and this is Rabbi Meir speaking, and the principle was Rabbi Meir held that we don't penalize Shogegs, we do penalize Mezids. So we should have expected it to say, like the previous line about Shabbos, if he did it on accident, not knowing it was Shabbos, not knowing it was the Shemitah year, we should let him keep the tree in the ground and only force him to uproot it if it was intentional. However, we don't say that. We say whether inadvertently planted or intentionally planted on Shemitah year, it must be uprooted. The reason why is because, and you'll recall this from Maseches Shviyas we just finished, is that the rabbis really threw their weight heavily against what must have been widespread, prevalent Shemitah violation in the time of Chazal. And since it was so common for people to basically cheat the system and lie and do things on Shemitah where they weren't allowed to do, the rabbis made a whole slew of derabbanans that are pretty pretty extreme in their aggressive posture. So the rabbis, if you recall, they pushed back all working of the lands like way into the sixth year where it didn't benefit the trees, etc. You'll recall there's an Isra Svichin. The Torah lets you eat the stuff which grows wild in the seventh year. The rabbi said most of that stuff is forbidden, etc. Again, because people were cheating the system and saying, oh, this wheat grew wild, when really the truth is the person planted the wheat and he's just lying. So similarly over here, since there's a widespread suspicion that Jews will flout the halachas of Shemitah and plant in the Shemitah year, the rabbis were very strict and they said, even if you claim it's just a shogeg and it was an accident, you didn't know it was Usr or Shvius, whatever the story is, and when you planted these seeds, forget it, we're still penalizing you. And we're saying, even Reb Meir here is saying, even if it was shogeg, when it comes to Shemitah, we are very strict and we will force you to get no benefits, even b'shogeg and certainly b'mezid, and force you therefore to uproot the tree. Trumos, Perik Beis, Mishnah Dalet 2:4. Ein tormin mimin al she'en amino. One can take truma from one type of food on behalf of another type of food. Each separate type has to be taken tithe separately. V'im tarim, and if one did, meaning if one had a container of wheat and a container of barley, each with, let's say, 50 cups of wheat and barley respectively, so you have to give one cup of wheat and one cup of barley as truma. If you opt to give two cups of wheat on behalf of both, even though they're both grain, for example, does not work. Im tarim, if you try to do that, ein truma so truma, what you call truma has no effect and you have to try again. Kol min chitim, however, all different types of wheat, echad, they're all considered one type, and you could take one on behalf of the other. We're not so familiar with wheat, but certainly we have things like many types of rice or many types of apples, so one could treat them all the same. Kol min te'enim, ugrogros, uduvela, echad, and figs. The way that figs came in the time of the Mishnah were in three totally separate guises. They could be fresh figs. A fresh fig is called a te'ena. It could be a dried fig. That's called a grogeris. The plural is grogros. Those dried figs taste much less good than a fresh fig, but last a lot longer. And then udvela. Udvela are pressed figs, like a mush fig cake. It's somewhere in the middle. Presumably tastes better than the grogeris and lasts longer than the fresh te'ena. So those are all considered to be echad, one species, meaning if you have te'enim, grogros, and dvela, you could take, let's say, 50 pounds of each. You could take 3 pounds from any of the above, and it would work. Torah mizeh al zeh, that's fungible. You can take truma one on behalf of the other. Now, which one should you take? Kol malkum she'esh kohen, if you have a kohen handy, so then torah min hayafet, take from the best, meaning the most tasty, meaning the fresh figs. But v'chol malkum she'ein kohen, if there's no kohen handy and therefore there's no certainty a kohen will ever get to the figs that you set aside as truma before they potentially spoil, then tar min hamitzkayim. Then you should take truma from the type of fig that will last the longest, that is to say, the dried figs. So the Tana Kama here, the halacha is like him, holds that we focus on the requirements from the Torah. Says chelbo, the best has to be given when you take truma, but we're focusing here on what the recipient will receive. And even though at the time of taking the truma, a fresh fig might be a better gift than a dried fig, but by the time it gets to the kohen, it's likely that it will only be if it's in the shape of a dried fig, it'll be much better because he receives it after some time than a fresh fig, which will spoil. So therefore, the Tana Kama holds, you should take from that which will be the best when it reaches the hand of the kohen, meaning you take from that which will last, the dried fig. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, La olam hutar min hayafe. Rabbi Yehuda holds no. You should always take from the best. And if it turns out that a kohen doesn't get it before it spoils, whatever it is, so that doesn't matter. That's besides the point. The point is that the Torah wants you to give from your best as an expression of your hakaras hatov, your gratitude to Hashem, and to give something back. In this case, you're giving something to the kohen, like Hashem's proxy, if you will. And therefore, we're focused on you, the giver, not necessarily the kohen, the receiver. And therefore, the Rabbi Yehuda says you give from the best and then let the chips fall where they may. However, like I said before, the halacha falls in Tana Kama that you take what will ultimately be the best when the Kohen receives it, as far as your best goes anyways, meaning if there is Kohanim present and prevalent, you'll give fresh, and if not, then you'll take from the dried fig that will last until a Kohen finally comes to your town to get Truma. Trumos, Perek Beis, Mishnah Hey, 2-5. This continues on the heels of the previous Mishnah, which had said, it raised the question, if you're tithing from figs, should you give from the better tasting fresh figs or the longer lasting dried figs? And the answer was, it depends on if you have Kohanim around. If you do, give from the better tasting, but if you have a question when a Kohen will get to it, then tithe from the longer lasting. The way the Bartanura learns the next Mishnah, meaning this Mishnah here of Mishnah Hey, is exactly the same, essentially. The first issue here is talking about tithing onions, and you have two onions. One is small and whole, and therefore, since it has never been opened, it will last longer, but taste less good. And the second is large, but has been opened, is cut in half, and that being the case, it will have a much shorter shelf life. And the Bartanura learns it's the exact same machlokas here, the difference just being that in the previous case, they were whole, and here they're, you know, all one species of onion, just whole and half. Before I say the Bartanura's pshat, which is the policy which I do follow in this Mishnah Yashir, I do want to say the pshat of the Rambam, because I like it very much as a important lesson for life. And this lesson for life, although the Bartanura wouldn't agree it applies to this particular Mishnah, because he has a different pshat in the Mishnah, he certainly would agree, because this principle is reflected elsewhere, like in the halachas of brachos. So first I'm saying according to the Rambam, and then I'll go back to the Bartanura. The Mishnah says, Tarmin batzal katan shalem, one should take truma from small, whole, complete onions, v'lo chatzi batzal gadol, as opposed to taking truma from a half, meaning a cut in half, larger onion. So, according to the Rambam in the Perush Mishnayos, the principle here is very straightforward and very yisodi, which is when you have a conflict between shlemus, wholeness, completion, totally well-rounded, and godless, something that's exceptional and extraordinary in a particular way. So the Torah's preference, what is considered to be chelbo, the better of the two, is shlemus. The Torah prefers shlemus to godless. And here in the case of a small onion versus a large but half onion, what's considered to be the better in terms of truma is the whole, even though it doesn't taste as good, because it's shalem, it's complete. And that's certainly a very big important lesson for life when it comes to human beings. And it's certainly reflected in other areas of halacha too, like for example in brachos, when you make a bracha, you should make a bracha on the shalem as opposed to the gadol, etc. But in any case, that's a Rambam in the Perush Mishnayos. The Bartanura learns this is the same case as before, same principle as before, basically meaning, excuse me, that a small onion doesn't taste as good but lasts longer, and a large onion tastes better, but if it's been cut open, it won't last long at all. And that being the case, the Mishnah says, assuming there's no Kohen handy, better to give from the small onion, which tastes less good but will last, than give him from the big onion, which may taste better now, but by the time the Kohen gets it, will have spoiled. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda is consistent with the Shita from the previous Mishnah. He says, Loki, absolutely not. Ela chatzi batzal gadol, you'd rather you give from the better now onion, meaning the big onion, which tastes better, even though it's cut in half, and if it doesn't last long enough for a Kohen to get to it, so be it. We're not focused on that, like you said before. V'chein, the same principle applies if you have high Rabbi Yehuda Omer, who used to say, Tormim b'tsalim mibnei ha-medina al ha-kufrim. If you have two types of onions, the onions that were of higher quality, let's call it, that ended up going to the cities to be sold over there for a higher price, those are called the Medina onions, and the kufrim are the local farm onions, which are less tasty but last longer. So, again, he says you should take from the Medina, the ones headed for the city, and not from the Kufrim, the local ones. Avlo mina Kufrim al b'nei ha-Medina. You may not do it the other way around. You can't, you shouldn't take the farm onions as a truma on behalf of the city onions. Now, the way I understand this Mishnah, here is the backstory. And I, this is a little bit speculative on my part, but I'm going to show you why I think this has to be the pshat. I suspect that if you always were a farmer and you're always having the local farm-grade onions, if they taste different, you might come to like that taste and expect that taste, and then, since you're accustomed to it, prefer that taste. And that being the case, the question could arise, you know, these farm onions are the local preference, because that's what they're used to, as opposed to the ones that are exported, which are quite different.
And therefore, the Mishnah is coming to tell you, at least Rabbi Yehuda is coming to tell you, that no, the city dwellers get the better onions, and they're objectively better. And the proof in the pudding is that the city dwellers could equally and easily purchase instead the small farm grade onions, but they don't, which tells you that they know the difference and they're choosing the better, which shows that the farm grade onions are inferior to the city grade onions. That's why I think the pshat is here. The reason why is because look at the Mishnah inside. It says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Tarmim Betzalim Mibnei Hamadina Al HaKufrim. You should take the city bound onions, that type. You can take tithing on behalf of the kufrim, the village onions, of a low min a kufrim al b'nei medina. But you shouldn't take the village grade onions on behalf of the city ones. And now he has to give a reason why. If he has to give a reason why, it must be that it's not evident from the tasting of them. And that must mean, at least I say, that it's because the local farmers might think, no, we like onions when they are. We actually prefer them because we're used to them. But he says, listen, mipnei shehu ma'achal politikin, since Rabbi Yehuda says, you see, the food of choice by those who have money, who can afford it in the cities, is for this type of onion, meaning the city grade onion. You see that they could choose, and they do choose that grade, and therefore that is objectively better, and therefore your subjective local tastes don't matter. It's the objectively better one, which you should take truma from, and that, in the case of the onions, is the Medina onions. Trumos, Perek Beis, Mishnah Vav, 2:6. We had said that the pasuk requires that when one takes his truma, it's barimchem es chelbo, one has to take the best quality as the truma. That's the mitzvah midoraisa, and that's certainly the chachila, the requirement. We've also said that you can't take on one species on behalf of a different species, one min on behalf of another min. So we see that there's a requirement to take from the better portion, but we're talking better in terms of quality, not better in terms of a better category of food. And so bringing those together, the Mishnah now is going to clarify some points here. It'll start by saying, V'tormen zeisei shemen al zeisei kevesh. If you have two different containers, one containing olives that are oily olives that can be used for pressing, and one to make olive oil, and the other contains olives that are ideal for pickling, and you would never press them because they're not that oily, those are called zeisei kevesh. Kevesh is like the kvisha is pickling, so these are like pickling olives. So we say that the better of the two, the higher quality food, even though they're both olives, is the zeisei shemen, the ones that would be pressed for olive oil. Now don't get confused here. We're not talking about a case where one would have otherwise pressed these olives to make oil. That would be the case. We'd have a separate problem of not tithing from that which hasn't finished being processed, of reaching gmar malacha. But these are olives that are the type of olives which could be pressed for oil, but in fact, you will not be pressing them for oil. So in that case, we say, the proper thing to do is to take from the zeisei shemen, the olive oil ones, as opposed to the zeisei kevesh, the ones that are normally designated for pickling, because they're the olive, the oily olives are of higher quality. As opposed to the other way around, velo zeisei kevesh al zeisei shemen. One should not take from the zeisei kevesh, the pickling olives, on behalf of the oil-producing olives, because they're of lesser quality, and that wouldn't be the chelbo, the better. The yain she'enu muvushal al hamavushal. Same goes if you have two containers, A and B, and A has muvushal wine that's been boiled already, and B has enu muvushal, wine that has not yet been boiled. So we say you could take from B on behalf of A, because the better quality stuff is the wine that has not yet been boiled. It's considered higher quality, and therefore that's the choice, and from there you should take your truma. And just to clarify, we're not necessarily talking about wine that was boiled because of the halachic considerations of yain mevushal has a different status with respect to non-Jews touching the wine, etc. In the time of Chazal, they frequently boil their wine just to reduce it and make it sweeter, etc. That being the case, however, it's not considered to be a superior quality. So if you have two kinds of wine, you want to take from the unboiled wine because it's considered to be higher quality. As opposed to v'lo min ha-muvushal al she'en ha-muvushal, you should not take from the boiled wine truma on behalf of the unboiled wine. Ze'a klal. Now this is the principle, but I've said many times before, and I'll have to say many times again, when the Mishnah says ze'a klal, this is the principle or the guiding principle, it doesn't mean that there's no exceptions. And I'll explain as follows here. Kol shehu kilayim b'chavero. If there are two species that are considered to be kilayim, forbidden to be planted together, that will clearly indicate that they're different minim. different types. And if that's the case, lo yisro mizel zeh, one is not allowed to take truma on one from one on behalf of the other, because they're considered two different species. And that's clearly reflected by the fact that they're considered kilayim. Afilu min hayafa al hara, even if what you're taking is from the better quality stuff. Let us say, for example, wheat and barley. So wheat and barley are kilayim, which clearly indicates that wheat and barley, although they're cereals, and can be used similarly, but they're different species, different minim. And as such, one cannot take truma from wheat on behalf of barley or vice versa. So you might have thought wrongly, and this is what the Mishnah comes to address, that you had, let's say, container A had barley, container B had wheat, and you say, listen, the wheat is, if I were a Kohen, I'd rather have wheat than barley, and wheat and barley are both grains, so I'm doing the Kohen a favor. I'll take two portions of truma from the wheat, and the Kohen's going to benefit because he gets no barley and extra wheat, which is what he probably wants because wheat's better than barley. No, 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 says the Mishnah, it doesn't work. You can't do that because wheat and barley are different species, and therefore you have to take one truma portion from each of the two containers, one on behalf of the wheat and one on behalf of the barley. Now, the other side of the coin, v'chol she'enu kilayim b'chavero, if two species are not kilayim one with the other, that means that they're similar to the point that you can plant them together. So, for example, the Mishnah back in Kilayim had said that oats and barley are considered to be a single type in as much as they're not kilayim to plant them together. So if you have oats in container A and barley in container B, one could take from B on behalf of both A and B, take from the oats or the barley on behalf of the other. Again, it'd be preferable to take the higher quality produce if there is an obvious higher quality. In the case of barley and oats, I'm not sure which that would be. But it's certainly permissible. Since they're, again, the Mishnah says, since they're not kilayim, that indicates they're the same min. Now, on that point, just understand, of course, it's not really a firm rule, it's just a guiding principle, and it's to guide you where things are quite similar. But there are plenty types of produce that are not a kilayim violation to plant together, yet are, must have truma taken from each one separately. For example, all trees don't have a kilayim problem, with the exception of grape vines in a vineyard, and which certainly does have kilayim issues. But to plant, for example, an olive tree in a vineyard is not kilayim. The only time you have kilayim when it comes to trees is not in a vineyard. There, it's only a restriction on grains and greens. As I've said many times, that's like, you know, but not trees. The only Torah prohibition about kilayim when it comes to trees outside of the world of grapevines is grafting the trees together. You know, you're not allowed to take the trunk of one and the rootstock of the other and put them together physically. But short of that, you're allowed to plant trees side by side, etc., and they're not kilayim, and yet certainly, while you could plant a apple and a pear tree side by side, there's no kilayim of apple and pear trees, it's certainly forbidden to take tithe your apples with the pears or vice versa. Okay, so this klal here is not totally without exceptions, or, you know, without a caveat. Fine. So the Mishnah says again, kol she'eno kilayim b'chavero, anything that's not kilayim with its fellow species, torem in hayafa al hara, then they're considered to be the same species, like, say, two different grades of rice or wheat, whatever the story is. Just take the better quality on behalf of the worse. Aval lo min hara al yafa, and l'charchila, you shouldn't take from the inferior type of, let's say, grain on behalf of the superior type. You have two kinds of wheat, you shouldn't take from the lesser inferior type of wheat. V'im tara min hara al hayafa, but if you did and took from the inferior type of wheat on behalf of the superior type of wheat, truma so truma, it does work b'diavad after the fact. One exception, chutz min hazunin. The exception is zunin. Zunin is darnel, D-A-R-N-E-L. Fascinatingly, here I don't know why the Art Scroll does not translate the word zunin at all. It did back in Kilayim, translating Zunin as darnel. And darnel is something really fascinating. Darnel is called false wheat. It's almost indistinguishable from wheat, and it grows with wheat. And in the time of in antiquity, a huge percentage of the wheat crops were adulterated with darnel. And darnel, unlike wheat, does not make you feel good. When you eat it, it makes you sick. Nauseous, you can pass out, you can even die from darnel poisoning. But in relatively small quantities, darnel is psychoactive and can make you sort of high, like drugs do. And that being the case, it seems that many people in antiquity actually had some dardel in their food, maybe on purpose, maybe on accident, both in bread as well as beer, and they were intoxicated by it. So I saw the art scroll, they put a footnote there, they suggested that zunin is from the word like zana, zonet, to turn aside, to turn away, like because it's sort of degenerate wheat. The word zunin actually, darnel, I should say, the word means to become like drunk or intoxicated. Maybe the same thing, it turns you away in terms of it turns your head away. Whatever the case, zunin, darnel, is no longer available in the Western world, although it still does plague people in Africa, etc., with their wheat crops. And since the zunin is not, although it's very similar to wheat, and it's not kilayim with wheat, if they are planted together, since zunin is not food for human beings, one may not take from the inferior zunin on behalf of the wheat and give that to the kohen, because it's not food at all. And that's what the Mishnah says here. The exception to two species that are not kilayim, yet if you take from the inferior, in this case the zunin, on behalf of the wheat, it won't work. Halachitim, because she'eno ochel, because zunin is not food at all. Finally, hakishus v'melefafon. Kishus is cucumber. Kishum in modern Hebrew is zucchini, but that's certainly wrong. Zucchinis came from Italy recently and were not available in time of Chazal. Melefafon, the kishus and the melefafon are considered one species. The Rambam here says it's essentially a Egyptian cucumber. Art scroll translated as kirbis. Kirbis basically are pickles. So they're very similar, and therefore they're menechad. Many others, however, learned that melefafon is a type of melon. And I guess if you look at cucumbers growing, and you look at watermelons growing, they look kind of similar in a way. So whatever the case, the kishus, let's translate it as cucumbers, and melefafon, either Egyptian cucumbers or, you know, melons, are min echad, they're considered a single species, and therefore you could take truma one on behalf of the other. Rabbi Yehuda omer, shnei minim. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Rabbi Yehuda says that indeed the kishus and the melefon are two different species, and you couldn't take truma one on behalf of the other. However, the halach is not like him. The halach is that the kishus and melefon are one species, and you could take truma one on behalf of the other.